Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. And the styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. So I've been using Armoire and I'm actually wearing one of their shirts right now as I'm recording this, and it's a great idea. You don't have to commit to buying the clothes, but you can really start to explore your own personal style. Like if there's a trend or something that you've been wanting to maybe try but not commit to, this is absolutely perfect. Because if you don't like it, you just put it back in the bag and get something else. Because we've all been there. You open your closet, and even though it's packed, you feel like you have nothing to wear. And with Armoire, that's a thing of the past. They make it effortless for all women to turn heads with stylish everyday looks. You can rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion, and it's all tailored to your personal style. Plus, you don't have to do laundry, and you don't have to go shopping. It truly could not be any easier. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month, which is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/ATTWG to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. Are you ready to lose weight? With Effecty, getting access to powerful GLP-1 weight loss medications has never been easier or more affordable. Effecty offers compounded semaglutide, the same active ingredient as the popular name brands, but for up to 80% less. These medications work by regulating appetite and blood sugar, helping you lose weight in a sustainable, science-backed way. Getting started is so simple. Just fill out a short medical questionnaire, then connect with a licensed provider through a quick chat-based telehealth consultation. If you're eligible, your prescription gets shipped straight to your door. No hassle, no waiting rooms. With transparent pricing, no hidden fees, and no membership required, Effecty is committed to making proven weight loss treatments accessible to everyone. Effecty gave me the opportunity to try their service out, and I have to say, it is just as easy as they say it is. I filled out the questionnaire, and within days, a package arrived at my door filled with everything I needed and detailed instructions. Their website also tells you everything you need to know, and you can always chat with your healthcare provider. It really is that simple and convenient. So if you're ready to level up your weight loss game, my listeners can now get $50 off of GLP-1 weight loss treatments at Effecty.com with code ATTWG at checkout. That's Effecty.com, EFFECTY.com, and use the code ATTWG to get $50 off your first month of GLP-1 weight loss treatment. No hassles, no memberships, and no hidden fees. So get started today. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, like, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick. that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
On January 29th, 2011, Bethany Decker called into her waitressing job to see if she could work the evening shift. She never made it to work that night. Her estranged husband, Emil Decker, was in Virginia on leave, but was due to ship back to Afghanistan just days later. Her boyfriend, Ronald Rolden, claimed that he saw her that afternoon at their apartment, but has no idea where she went after that. It would take over 10 years and a brutal assault, but an arrest would be made in Bethany Decker's case. But why did it take so long? What new evidence appeared in the intervening decade that finally led to Bethany's family getting answers? When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you about the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Bethany Decker. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
And welcome to part two of the Bethany Decker case. Now, this week, we're going to be picking up where we left off about 4 years after Bethany was last seen in her Ashburn, Virginia apartment. So we're going to give just a quick rundown here. In 2011, Bethany was young, pregnant, and involved in an abusive relationship from which she could not seem to extricate herself. While many fingers initially pointed toward her estranged husband, suspicion quickly turned to her live-in boyfriend. In the months leading up to her disappearance, Bethany confided in family and friends that she feared for her safety and that Ronald Rolden had been abusive toward her. Between her 2011 disappearance and where we're picking up in 2016, Rolden had been charged with physically abusing one girlfriend in Virginia and trying to murder another girlfriend in North Carolina. The charges in the first case were dismissed, and he pled guilty to lesser charges in the second. He was serving his sentence for those crimes in North Carolina. Before we kind of get into what happened starting in 2016 in Bethany's case, like, what are your thoughts as to where we are right now?
It seems as though Loudoun County sheriffs, like whoever the investigator was, really dropped the ball and missed a lot of opportunities to get forensic evidence. I don't understand why they didn't search the apartment that she and Rolden were living in. I don't understand why they didn't take her car and search her car.
Yeah, it's so bizarre to me. Like, I can't figure it out either. But what I find interesting is that when I was researching this and when I was writing this, I was so stuck on the fact that they didn't search her apartment. I honestly didn't even think about the car until you brought it up.
So they went through the trouble of jumping to the conclusion that she was already dead.
Right, which would be the only reason they would be searching the field by her house.
Right, which is where I was going with that.
Yeah. Like,
they went through all of that trouble. Mm-hmm. They got a helicopter, they had cadaver dogs, they had ATVs apparently, which I didn't even know that Loudoun County sheriffs had.
Me neither, I don't know.
All to search this field, presumably looking for a body.
Yeah.
But they didn't bother to get a search warrant for the apartment in which she lived.
Yeah, and I find it interesting, right? Because, like,
you could think perhaps they applied for a search warrant and couldn't get a judge to sign off on it for whatever reason, but they were able to secure the search warrant for his mother's home in Fairfax.
Right.
So it's like if they were able to get a judge to sign off on that.
Right. In a house that she had never lived in. Come on.
Yeah. And again, like I said before, it makes sense because he was there. They were trying to get his electronics. Presumably sure, the electronics were with him.
But that wasn't the only thing listed on the search warrant.
Correct. They were looking for bodily fluids.
Right. Forensic evidence of a crime, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is baffling why that only happened in Roldan's mother's house and not in the house in which Bethany Decker was last seen.
Right. Exactly. None of it makes any sense. And you can't even put up the argument that her name was on the lease exclusively.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's not like he had any
claim to it legally or whatever.
Yeah.
That baffles me. I don't know what happened to her car. It just seems like they left a lot of holes in the initial investigation.
And I think there's also a lot of holes in the reporting too, which is why I'm going to retry for that FOIA request and just see, because like,
that's
this
true.
Is
so maybe
bothering me.
Maybe we don't know. Maybe they did some things that we don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm assuming they did, but like, oh, we're going to get to some more stuff later that I really want to get the FOIA request because I'm hoping I'm misunderstanding something. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. After Roldan's conviction for such a violent crime against an intimate partner, Loudoun County probably felt a little pressure. After all, the case could be made that if they had done a better job in the initial investigation into Bethany's disappearance, Vicki Willoughby would still have both of her eyes. So in July of 2016, sheriff's detectives got back on the stick. Though Bethany's case was always technically open, not much progress had been made on it since 2011. A few months after Roldan's conviction in North Carolina, the LCSO filed a search warrant requesting access to a cell phone, tablet, and laptop belonging to Roldan.
Current cell phone, laptop, and computer or tablet?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Okay. I'm curious as to how they were able to get that search warrant.
Right. I do not.
A search warrant for.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. And remember when they did search his mother's house, they confiscated several electronics back in 2011, but failed to turn up any evidence then, presumably, that would help them with their case. So I guess by confiscating all this stuff 5 years later, they were hoping that like he had been talking to somebody about what he had done to Bethany.
Like he just like dropped a couple of emails or instant messages saying, talking, oh yeah, BT dubs, I killed my ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, like what? I don't even know what they were trying to get at this point that didn't exist in 2011.
Who knows?
In November of 2020, when his sentence was up in North Carolina, Roldan was charged with abducting Bethany Decker and extradited back to Virginia. A probable cause affidavit laid out the evidence against Roldan. What I find striking about it is that none of it seemed new. All of it seems as though it either was gathered in 2011 or could have been gathered in 2011.
Okay, well, let's hear it.
What this affidavit does is kind of fill in some of the blanks with the information that we already knew, right? So like we knew that Bethany called Carrabba's the afternoon of January 29th. It had been reported at the time that she had been like calling to get her schedule for the week. But according to the affidavit, Bethany called Carrabba's at 2:08 p.m. She asked to work the evening shift that night, but she never showed. That was the last communication from Bethany's phone, and no cell tower location information was ever recovered. Now, that's worded oddly. And at first, I took that to mean that maybe they didn't try to get cell phone
location data. That's what I was about to ask, yes.
But they got Roldan's cell phone location data. So what I'm taking that to mean is that they didn't recover any data after 2:08 p.m., basically.
Okay.
So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and just think that this was worded oddly.
Yeah, because the way it was worded sounded like they were just like, they didn't try.
Right. And that's kind of what I thought at first. But again, but based on what they're about to talk about with Roldan's phone, I'm thinking it's just worded weird.
Okay.
Roldan had told detectives in 2011 that Bethany had left that afternoon on the 29th, but that he didn't know where she was going. Quote, and this is a quote from the affidavit. The accused was allegedly unaware of Decker's destination or her time of return. The accused was also unable to provide a description of the clothes worn by Decker when she left the apartment. End quote. Roldan sent two texts to Bethany's phone, one at 4:01 p.m. and one at 4:31 p.m., to tell her that he would be watching his children at the apartment for the next few days.
Wait, he has kids too?
Yep. Roldan has two children with a previous girlfriend. Those are the children to which this is referring. In fact, at the time he met Bethany, Roldan, who was around 30, had at least four children by three different women.
Okay.
In between the two texts he sent to Bethany's phone, Roldan made an ATM withdrawal at 4:26 p.m. Cell phone tower data shows that he was in Sterling, which is the next town over, during this time. Now, I don't know the exact bank that he was at, but based on where they lived in Ashburn, I mean, that could have been like a 5-minute drive.
Right.
So like, yes, he was the next town over, but not necessarily in a weird way, you know. He returned to the apartment shortly thereafter, and his ex-girlfriend dropped their children off. She said around 4:30. So again, like, he made this ATM withdrawal at 4:26. I'm sure he wasn't home exactly at 4:30, but yes, around 4:30 is totally reasonable. Now, when the ex-girlfriend was interviewed by detectives later, again, back in 2011, from my understanding, this is not like a new interview, she told them that when she dropped the children off, Roldan told her that he didn't know if Bethany would be returning, which seems to be a weird thing to say about somebody who just left the house 2 hours ago.
Right. Randomly.
Randomly, right? Or like, you know, presumably to go to work or right. whatever, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I don't know if she's ever coming back is kind of a strange thing to say that soon. Then when the girlfriend came back a few days later to pick the kids up, he told her that Bethany had in fact not returned. She pointed out that Bethany's car was in their parking lot, but quote, the accused could not offer any reasonable answer as to why the vehicle remained in the lot, end quote. So it sounds like both in his interview to police and his ex-girlfriend's interview to police that like he could not come up with a good reason why this car was there.
Right.
So like that's a lot of red flags, right? I mean, if he's telling the girlfriend one thing, he's telling police another, and none of it makes sense, like that's a problem.
Yeah.
The PC affidavit also had more information about Bethany's Facebook account. Records obtained via a January 2019 warrant, and I know I am saying that very pointedly because that is very important to me and is driving me completely insane. A January 2019 warrant to Facebook showed that both Bethany and Roldan's Facebook accounts were accessed from the same IP address beginning on February 16th and going until she was reported missing on February 19th. So two big things here. One, that seems to show that one person was accessing both Ronald Roldan and Bethany Decker's Facebook profiles.
They're both from the same IP address, but if...
within minutes of each other.
But if they lived in the same address, it would be the same IP address.
I know, but this was 2 weeks after she disappeared.
Right.
So not only does this prove what has been a huge issue since the very beginning, but it seems like it was right there for the taking in 2011. So why did it take until 2019 for them to get this information?
Right. That is very telling.
According to the sheriff's office, they needed better technology to pinpoint the origination of suspicious online activity.
What?
Right. Now, you're famously not good with technology.
No, but I sure as fuck understand how, like, IP addresses work. And, like, that technology is not new at all. In fact, 20 plus years ago, when you and I were in college, I knew what an IP address was, and I knew exactly, like, that was trackable and traceable.
Yeah. So that was my thought when I saw that. I was like, that's an interesting statement to make because I don't feel like any of that is new. But, you know, what do I know? Like, IT is not my thing. I'm a realtor. I was in marketing, like, whatever.
I'm a dumb cop. And I understand that, like, the traceability of people going online has been around for many, 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 many years.
Correct.
So, like, for them to make that statement is just asinine.
So as it happens, as I was writing this part, I got a phone call from someone who has worked in IT since the early 90s. When he asked me how I was doing, I answered, "In 2011, did Facebook have the technology to be able to determine what IP address was used to access a Facebook account?" Which was not the response he was expecting to that question.
I'm fine, by the way.
Yeah. But he did tell me that when he worked for a small internet service provider in the late 90s, he was actually the guy who would get warrants like this and would have to come up with this type of information. And he confirmed that he was able to find out way more complex information than an IP address, and that unless someone was deliberately trying to cloak their IP address, that this was incredibly easy information to figure out, even back then. And we're talking about the 90s. And he did give the caveat of, like, provided that they're on, you know, hardwired internet or, like, Wi-Fi, not necessarily a cell network, because that can, you know, potentially lead to a little bit more confusion. But typically, it's still very easy information to gather. I then asked him if there are any technological advancements between 2011 and 2019 that would have substantially changed LCSO's ability to retrieve this information, and he said that, to his knowledge, there had not been. Now, look, this is one IT professional's opinion who just had the bad luck of calling me at the wrong time when I was knee-deep in this case, but it does confirm the gut reaction that both you and I had when we read this, that the sheriff's department just came up with this new technology thing to cover their ass for dropping the ball on this investigation in 2011.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. 100%. They never looked into it in 2011. That's really what it was.
That's the thing. So, like, they looked into it in that they seized his, like, phone and computer and, like, you know, all of that stuff. They presumably looked through it. I'm sure they, like, you know, tried to log on to his Facebook account. Sure. They tried to log on to her Facebook account, whatever. But, like, you can't just log on to somebody's Facebook account and necessarily prove that somebody else had been using it, right? Like, that's not how that works.
Right.
So in 2011, whatever they did end up finding on these devices, it wasn't this, and it wasn't what they needed. Oh, and we also learned something else from the PC affidavit that has nothing to do with supposed new technology. Among the items seized from Roldan's mother's house in 2011 were a key and a key fob belonging to Bethany's car.
That we still don't know what happened to it.
Right. And now I find it odd that he had the key and the key fob to Bethany's car and could have moved it somewhere.
But it had a flat tire.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, and I don't know when or how or why that happened.
Maybe that's something that should have been investigated.
Perhaps. Mm. Perhaps.
Mm.
There are more clues pertaining to the car and to our knowledge. Again, like, oh, God, I really want this. I really want to get this case file. But, like, yeah, there's just, we don't know. It's a big question mark, like, everything that happened to the car. Because, again, like, the flat tire, no idea. She made it from Columbia, Maryland to Ashburn, Virginia the night of the 28th.
Right. So presumably. It's not like the flat tire happened in Columbia or
halfway
or
and then
whatever.
Something nefarious happens.
Right.
Like
the car was in the parking lot.
At her apartment.
Yes. Granted, parked at an odd angle, but like.
Yeah. It does seem as though whatever happened to the tire happened like perhaps in the parking lot because Evelyn, Bethany's grandmother, she's the one who first said that the car was parked in an odd angle when they went to her apartment on February 19th. She said it almost looked like it had been like pushed into the space, which if you get a flat tire, it makes sense that you would like push the car, maybe. I don't know. But like, you can kind of see it. Or if you got a flat tire, like you're not going to do the best parking job, right?
Right. Because that'll affect steering.
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, like that kind of makes sense as to why it was parked oddly. But yeah, there's definitely a lot more seemingly, perhaps, maybe, that could be discovered from this car. So back to Ronald Roldan. He was said to be released from prison in North Carolina and deported to Bolivia in 2020. Instead, he was extradited back to Loudoun County, Virginia on a charge of abduction. He was remanded to the Loudoun County Adult Detention Center. On December 17th, 2020, the abduction charge was upgraded to second-degree murder.
I mean, based on what?
I don't know. And honestly, his public defender kind of had that same question, like which we'll get to in a moment. In 2021, early, I want to say probably like around May, Roldan's public defender, Lori O'Donnell, filed a motion to preclude jurors from hearing about his attempted murder conviction in North Carolina. In the motion, she said, quote, "There is no specific proof or direct evidence that Bethany Decker is deceased. There is no direct evidence that a murder was committed. There is no crime scene. There is no murder weapon. There is no evidence of foul play. It is well established that evidence of other offenses should be excluded if offered merely for the purpose of showing that the accused was likely to commit the crime charged in the indictment." End quote. And like, listen,
That's all valid.
Right?
100%.
I mean, I 100% believe that Ronald Roldan killed Bethany Decker on January 29th. That is also valid to me. I mean, that motion.
Oh, yeah.
Makes complete sense given what we know.
Right. Yeah.
Because at this point, she's right. Like, there is no physical proof that Bethany is dead. Reasonably, yes, she absolutely is. It's been 10 years.
But it's all circumstantial.
Right. And again, a circumstantial case is fine. You can have a circumstantial case and convict somebody. Like, that's not the issue. But her point, it is well established that evidence of other offenses should be excluded if offered merely for the purpose of showing that the accused was likely to commit the crime charged in the indictment. Like, that is why they're putting in this North Carolina offense because it was after Bethany, right?
Yeah.
So like it obviously had nothing to do with what happened to Bethany. It's showing a pattern of behavior.
Right.
I get her point on that, but her motion was denied.
Yes, 100%. I understand her point, but also good.
Yeah, right. At a hearing a few months later in August of 2021, Roldan's attorney requested access to Emil Decker's military records, saying that he had never been eliminated as a suspect. Public defender Ashima Rotra told Judge Douglas Fleming that the sheriff's department did a, quote, woefully inadequate job, end quote. Like, which I agree, but for different reasons. More interestingly, he also claimed that Emil failed a polygraph test about his wife's disappearance.
First time hearing about this.
Yeah, this is the only time I have heard about this. And when we don't know for sure if he's referring to the polygraph that Emil took in 2011 when he first came back from Afghanistan and was interrogated, but nobody has any knowledge of there being another polygraph. So it's likely that that's the one to which they're referring, but the Sheriff's Department never released the results of that. So this is clearly something that, you know, got brought up in discovery or, you know, whatever. So yeah, this is the first time that anybody's hearing about that. Now, he says that he failed it, but like, what does that mean, right? You know,
nothing. That's inadmissible in court now.
Yeah, it's inadmissible.
That doesn't prove anything.
But a polygraph also isn't. It's not a pass fail grade either, right?
Right. Yes.
So like, he could have shown deception about some aspects, but not necessarily aspects that were actually material to Bethany's disappearance. You know, it could have been something related to their relationship, what he knew when, you know, just things like that. Not necessarily like, did you kill your wife? No, you're lying. You're like, that's not necessarily what this is saying at all. Though it could be. We don't know. So that I thought was a very interesting point that was brought up in this hearing, in this motion. Marotra also said that a federal investigation into Emil Decker was undertaken by the U.S. Army's Criminal Investigation Command, though he didn't elaborate on the extent of that investigation. And to me, I don't know anything about like the Army's investigative unit or whatever, but to me, that kind of sounds scarier than I bet it is. I would assume that you have a guy who's new, who's just deployed to Afghanistan. His wife was last seen 3 days prior to his deployment. Foul play might be afoot. Police want to question him. I think it's normal that the Army would also do some sort of investigation into this.
Yeah, I'm sure that's exactly what it was. It was either, quote unquote, joint investigation with LCSO, or they did some sort of paperwork, essentially.
Yeah.
Just saying that they aided in the investigation.
Right. I mean, I have to think that they would want to look into it a little bit, right? And it can't just be like, oh, hey, I got this thing going back in Virginia that I need to like go hang out and talk to some cops for a while. And like, I can't see the Army being like, oh, cool. Let us know how it goes. We'll see you in a week.
No, they would definitely open some sort of case file on it. But to what extent the investigation would go into would probably not be very in-depth.
Right. And we'd never know, you know, any more about this. Because again, like, this is just something that Roldan's public defender brought up in a hearing. This is not part of a trial. This is not, you know, something that anybody was testifying to.
Right. And even if you do get your FOIA request granted, that's probably not going to be be mentioned in it.
Yeah. Now, Judge Fleming did say that the defense's request to get basically all of Emil's military records was too broad, but he did agree that the defense had a point in that Emil hadn't been officially ruled out, and it was certainly in the defense's best interest to find out more about him and, you know, to get more information on him. So given that, Judge Fleming did grant defense access to financial records from the time period surrounding Bethany's disappearance, as well as, quote, any alleged violence or anger issues, end quote, found in Emil's military record. So that's the thing. He said that he wasn't going to grant them access to his entire record, but if there's anything about violence or anger issues, like, yes, you should be able to know that.
I mean, it's basically the same as him granting the jury hearing the violence in Roldan's past. Like, you can't do one and not the other.
Yeah, I think that because that makes sense.
In a trial, you have to give the defense the opportunity to present alternate suspects.
Sure. Though different representatives from the sheriff's office had said publicly over the years that he wasn't a suspect, that Emil wasn't a suspect. Like, yes, officially, sure. Like, he's not ruled out, right? Like, there's no definitive proof that he was not involved in this.
That also shows the lackluster investigation. They should have come up with a way to rule him out.
Yeah, and it sounds like they basically did, right? Because, like, when he came back from Afghanistan for the face-to-face interviews and they interrogated him for several hours, the big questions that they were asking, one was, what did you know about this relationship and when did you know it, right? Because the general impression was that either Emil didn't know about the baby and found out that Bethany was pregnant with somebody else's baby after he got back from Afghanistan and freaked out, or he knew she was pregnant but thought the baby was his, or, you know, some other thing that involved him finding out about her double life and him just killing her in a jealous rage, right? So,
well, sure, those are all the theories behind.
Yeah, those are all the theories, right? And now, by that point, by the time he came back, they knew that whatever happened to her hadn't happened the night of the 28th when he was the last person to see her. They knew she was alive on the 29th, but she, according to Roldan, walked out of their apartment the afternoon of the 29th of her own free will, was not seen again, and Emil Decker was in Virginia until February 2nd. So the big thing
was his alibi.
Exactly. So yes. That was the big part of that interrogation, was finding out where he was for those 3 days and who he was with and all of that, right?
So now, do we know any of that?
We don't know any of that. They never released any specific information. And that's something that Emil didn't directly address in that episode that disappeared, right? Like, he talked about the interrogation, but he didn't say, and this is where I was on the 30th and this is where I was on the 31st. But, you know, presumably his alibis were good enough that he wasn't really pursued as a suspect after that. But neither was Ronald Roldan until several years later. But in any case, Roldan's defense was granted access to parts of his military records in hopes of finding something in Emil's past that indicated violence or anger. Because unlike Roldan, he didn't have a civil criminal record. Beyond the attempted murder and everything that happened in North Carolina and everything else that happened after Bethany's disappearance, he had charges before that, right? And they were minor charges, but they were like vandalism. They were identity theft. They were things that, while minor, would point to his eventual pattern, you know, identity theft. Like, I don't know the details of that charge, but he impersonated Bethany on Facebook. Like, was it something along those lines, or was it just stealing somebody's credit card? Like, who knows? But you can see what the defense was doing, right? Like, they were trying to find toeholds in this case that, as we said before, was circumstantial. As Roldan's defense pointed out, there was no body, no crime scene, and no forensic evidence linking Roldan or anyone else to Bethany's supposed murder. In fact, there is no hard evidence that she had been murdered at all. All of 2021 and the majority of 2022 were spent with motions and hearings preparing for the trial, which was set to begin in February of 2022, then January of 2023. And it was scheduled to last for 4 weeks. My plan was to attend the trial and cover it for the show. And I attended several of the pretrial hearings leading up to that. But like he did in North Carolina, Roldan was able to avoid facing a jury. Perhaps concerned about the lack of physical evidence in their case, the Commonwealth Attorney's Office offered Roldan a plea deal. On November 17th, 2022, Roldan pled guilty to second-degree murder. Just this past week, on February 21st, 2023, he had a sentencing hearing. Bethany's family and friends were able to read victim impact statements in court. Her younger siblings talked about how they have been diagnosed with PTSD because of this. Her brother, Richard Littlejohn, was only 13 when Bethany disappeared. He said that he always beat himself up for not trying harder to get his sister to leave Roldan. As the years passed with no resolution, he said that he contemplated suicide and is still in therapy. He told the court, quote, "I still don't know how to handle it. It mangled my childhood. I wanted to be a normal kid, but I never could. I learned hope was bad because hope leads to suffering," end quote. Evelyn Bales, Bethany's grandmother, said that she also dealt with guilt because she couldn't convince her granddaughter to stay in Maryland that last night. Quote, "I couldn't save her." Kimberly testified, quote, "We had been hoping she could escape. We had been planning it for a while, but it didn't happen. She thought she could control the situation, but she couldn't," end quote. Roldan was given a chance to speak as well, but he chose not to. If convicted of second-degree murder in Virginia, you can be sentenced from 5 to 40 years in prison. As part of his deal, Roldan was sentenced to the maximum of 40 years, but 27.5 of those years were suspended, meaning he will only serve 12.5 years for the murder of Bethany and her unborn baby.
And as part of that plea deal, they didn't get her body or anything?
That was my first question when I heard that he had pled guilty. I was hoping that part of his deal was that he had to tell authorities where Bethany's body is so her family could finally lay her to rest. As we found out just a few days ago, as part of his plea deal, Roldan agreed to divulge how he killed Bethany and disposed of her body. In a taped interview from January 9th of this year, Roldan said that on the afternoon of January 29th, 2011, he and Bethany argued because he didn't want her to go to work that evening. When she walked away from him, he said that he shoved her and she struck her head against a windowsill. He checked her pulse and determined that she was dead.
Okay. Did he also do CPR? Because I think I've heard this story before.
Yeah. You know, they say the best lies have a grain of truth to them. And so I want to play a quick 6-second clip from the 2012 episode of Disappeared. Now, this is Bethany's mother speaking.
Bethany told me there was a situation where she was pushed across the room and hit the wall.
Sounds pretty close to the story that he told 12 years later about how she died.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm sure that at some point, maybe even that day, he did push her across the room. Maybe she even hit her head on a windowsill. But I do not believe for a second that this is the version of events that actually resulted in Bethany Decker and her unborn child losing their lives.
Yeah, I would agree.
I believe that while her murder probably wasn't premeditated, neither was it an accident.
Oh, yeah, no. Absolutely not an accident.
I believe that they did get into a fight. Maybe it was about work. Maybe it was about a meal. Maybe it was about a baby. But I believe that Roldan then murdered Bethany in a violent rage in their apartment. Of course, I have no proof of this. No one does. Because a forensic search of the apartment where they lived and Bethany likely died was never performed.
Thank you.
The windowsill that she allegedly struck her head on was never tested for blood. Nothing was looked at in that apartment from a forensic standpoint. Any evidence that could have been there was never recovered.
Right. So if we're going by his story, right, you already said it. There would have potentially been blood, hair, some sort of forensic evidence on the windowsill, assuming that she basically bled out from her head injury, there would have been blood on the carpet.
Right.
Right. Even if he cleaned it up, like there still would have been some evidence of it.
Yeah, because luminol, yes, it catches bleach and blood. Like, right, you know, I mean,
you might not have been able to get a DNA sample if he, right, cleaned it up properly, but you'd be able to tell that there was some bodily fluid that was there.
Yeah, or attempts to clean up something, right? Right? Even that, right? Even just attempt to clean up something would have been more physical evidence
than literally nothing.
Yeah. Roldan went on to detail in this taped interview how he disposed of his girlfriend's body. And this part to me is both plausible and infuriating. He said that after Bethany hit her head and accidentally died, he said that he feared no one would believe that it was an accident. So instead of calling 911, he wrapped her body in a Christmas tree bag. Now, Bethany was tiny, only about 4'11" and 130 pounds. And this was January. So it makes sense that there was a Christmas tree bag just hanging around. He then took her wrapped body and threw her in a trash compactor in their apartment complex. A trash compactor that was also never searched.
I can't speak to that specific apartment complex.
Mm-hmm.
But I have never seen a trash compactor in an apartment complex in Ashburn.
Yeah, I know. I mean,
I have seen dumpsters, obviously.
Yeah, obviously. But like, yeah,
I thought the same thing. Never seen a trash compactor.
Yeah, I thought the same thing, but like, I don't know. Because of this, Bethany's body has likely been in the Loudoun County landfill since 2011. And her family will never have the opportunity to give her a proper burial. Despite all of this, Bethany's family is relieved to see Roldan finally convicted for Bethany's murder. At a press conference after the sentencing, Kimberly told reporters that she supported the plea deal. She also thanked police and prosecutors for their efforts to get justice for Bethany and other domestic violence victims.
So, well, I appreciate Kimberly saying that. I, for one, am pissed off at Loudoun County's lack of investigation in this. There are so many holes in this that could have been solved if the proper investigation had been done years ago. And I know we don't have all of the information. I understand that. But zero chance that they actually searched the apartment. We still have no idea what happened to her car. They clearly didn't search the trash compactor, even though I don't think that there was a trash compactor. They spent all of their time on the vacant field next to the apartment complex, just assuming that her body would be there.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I also thought that that's where she was. Because before I started researching this case, I didn't know that they had searched that field. But like every time we drove by there and I saw that field, I was like, that's
sure. Yes,
that's where she is. Sure. You know?
But they also at this point still had no evidence that a murder had taken place.
Right.
Or that she was dead. They just randomly started searching a fucking field instead of going the scientific route and doing a proper police investigation and trying to find forensic evidence of what happened to her in her own apartment. And hey, look, if we get the FOIA request back and they did do some sort of search of the apartment, great. I'll fully admit to being wrong.
Yeah, right. As will I. I mean, the Fairfax search warrant was reported on in various news outlets. It was also mentioned in the episode of Disappeared. Crystal Owens, the reporter, said, "We got a tip from our sister newspaper in Fairfax County that a search warrant had been issued there," right?
But nobody reported anything about a search warrant being done in her own actual apartment.
Correct. This isn't an issue of like, oh, maybe a local newspaper missed that. we had the Washington Post reporting on this. You know, this was on, like I said, Nancy Grace. You know, this was on that. And Nancy Grace on that show talked about the Fairfax search warrant, but
didn't mention anything about the search being conducted of her apartment.
Right.
Yeah.
It's so frustrating because when the news came out that he had gone down to North Carolina, assaulted and shot his girlfriend in the face and mentioned obliquely, as it may have been, Bethany, saying, "I've made people disappear. I can make you disappear too," you know, something along those lines. Like, I just remember sitting in my house just being furious that he had gotten away with it for this long, had done something similar to somebody else, and seemingly the Loudoun County Sheriff's Department still wasn't doing anything, right? And they were. I mean, they were doing things behind the scenes in 2015, 2016, et cetera. Yes. But it still wasn't until 2019 that they got
the Facebook records.
Like, I'm sorry. And when they finally decided that they had enough to make the case, like I said, nothing was new.
Right.
They didn't have any additional information. There was no reason, from what I have been able to find, that they couldn't have brought this exact same case in 2011.
The only additional information that they have is the fact that he tried to kill somebody.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, that's it.
That's absolutely it. And if Judge Fleming hadn't denied the defenses, in my opinion, my non-legal opinion, very reasonable motion to exclude that information,
then they would have had nothing.
And I have so much empathy and sympathy for Bethany's family, and especially her mother. And, you know, I get why she was thinking everybody, and I get why she was behind the plea deal.
Yes.
Like, I get all of 100%, that. 100%. Like, I'm not saying that she should be doing anything different than what she is doing.
No, but you and I can be infuriated by this. Because this is our local police department. We live here, and we know that this is not the only investigation that they have botched.
Right.
I mean, look, hey, anybody that wants to live in Loudoun County, it's beautiful. Just don't ever get murdered here, because that case will never be solved.
Bethany spoke with her mother while she was at her grandparents the last night she was alive. Kimberly was able to tell her oldest daughter that she loved her, not knowing it would be the last time they would ever speak. At the press conference, she said, quote, "I just want to encourage each and every one of you not to take tomorrow for granted. Make sure you are talking to your loved ones, that you're letting people know that you care and not waiting for the tomorrow, which may never come," end quote. Bethany Ann Little John Decker has been missing from Ashburn, Virginia since January 29th, 2011. She was a white female with brown hair and brown eyes and was approximately 4'11" and 130 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She's about 3 months pregnant. Bethany was a victim of intimate partner violence. If any of the situations in these last two episodes sound familiar to you or someone you know, please contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. You can also text START to 8788 or visit thehotline.org. Since Bethany's disappearance, her mother, Kimberly Nelson, has been involved in the organization Help Save the Next Girl. Help Save the Next Girl was started by the Harrington family, whose daughter Morgan, a Virginia Tech student, was murdered in 2009 after attending a concert in Charlottesville. Their primary focus is to spread safety information and prevent future crimes against young women. You can learn more and get involved at helpsavethenextgirl.com. You can see all the sources for this episode, along with photos and videos, at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social. And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!